You're listening to Radio Reverb 97.2 FM in the Brighton area and RadioReverb.com online. Welcome to the UK's only radio show about HIV and living a healthy life. It's the HIV Hour. Do contact us on thehiv@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at HIV_hour. Or listen and subscribe to iHIV Hour podcasts, iTunes, Deezer and Spotify. Just type in HIV Hour. If you miss the show on a Thursday at 7 p.m, then you can listen again 4 p.m. on the Monday and Tuesday at noon. Or indeed catch up with an older show by going to the Listen Again page on RadioReverb.com. Hey, good evening. How are you?
Well, hi. All right. Yes. I think we're all well, aren't we?
Just about, yeah. On this lovely Thursday evening.
Well, it's February as well. Where did January go?
Down the plug hole.
Yes. Like last year.
Gosh. Blimey.
Yes, how are you both? How are you, Sue?
Still got lots of work. I thought it'd be quiet after Christmas, and it seems relentless, which is a positive thing. Because you probably know I do a lot of community talks with organisations, schools and colleges. And I think one of the things I think we've had a surge on is because of this 5-part documentary, The Sin, on the television.
Yes.
So I'm getting a lot of requests. And don't forget, guys, it's also LGBTQ+ History Month this month, isn't it? So I'm getting lots of sort of inquiries into doing talks, you know, for those two things. So
that's good. Keeping busy with the hub and delivering food on a Friday and the 2 SCI chef thing. Yeah, I'm just busy. Just, you know, busy. What about you, Josh?
I'm busy-ish. Yeah, I always forget what I do, don't I, really? It's a great interview with Roland Chesters, which you'll be listening to later. Mm. Just Radio Reverb's going well. We're just, we're in the middle of HIV National Testing Week, aren't we? So.
Yes, we are. So yeah, a very different one, isn't it, this year? Yeah, no, so that started on Monday, didn't it? So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's on the show then? I've got a great interview with Roland Chesters, I think you interviewed 2018, Sue, did you?
Yes, yeah. I know Roland personally, and he's probably done twice as much than what he'd done a couple of years ago. But I know back then we had him on the show to do a book review, Ripples from the Edge of Life, and he was...
Yes.
And I know you've had an amazing interview with him, so that's going to be really exciting to hear today.
Yeah, it was a good interview, so yeah.
Good.
Looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. How about you, Tony? You got a story?
Lunch Positive have got a new incentive coming up with friendship and with basically keeping in touch with people. If you're feeling a bit low, you can contact people, and then, you know, it's good. It's online, and it's also like on the phone or via Zoom or whatever. So it's a good thing. So I'm going to speak to Gary about that.
Is that like a budgeon?
Buddying, like peer support, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
I did read that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be really good. So.
Mm-hmm. What about the LGV story?
Yes, LGV story as well, which is the bump of new infections through people, you know, using PrEP, etc., and that, you know, more infections are coming through. But yeah,
sure.
And your good self, Sue.
Oh my god! Oh well, really interesting. A couple of years ago, I went forward to be an organ donator, and that was about 2-3 years ago. So basically, back then, HIV positive people could go on the donor list. I've got my little sort of pink card very nicely in my wallet. And basically, if something was to happen to me, my organs would go to another HIV positive person. What is happening now that they are going to be doing a research into whether positive people can go on the donor list and their organs can be donated to negative people.
Wow, cool.
That's amazing.
You know, I mean, here's a thought, just a quick thought. Yeah. You've got a partner, you've got a lover, you've got a friend, you've got a child. They've been on the donor list for years, and that organ hasn't become available. All of a sudden, there's a donor, there's an organ donor available. That person's HIV positive. Do you take that organ? Okay, that person will be on antivirals for the rest of their life, but they'll be alive, they'll be well, they'll be living. Yeah. That is an exciting thing, hopefully, that may be trialed, rolled out. So that really interesting piece of news.
Mm. Really good.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how you think about that and how people would go forward.
HIV Hour is the UK's only show for people living with HIV, sharing stories, news and views on living positively with the virus.
So welcome back to the HIV Hour. It's 97.2 FM, RadioReverb.com. I've got a very special guest with me today. It's Roland Chesters. He's been on the show before, I think. Was that right, Roland?
January 2018.
Right, just before I started, I think. Yeah, so he's an author and advocate for people living with disability. And he's got many strings to his bow. So how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. As good as can be expected under current circumstances.
Yeah, how's it going?
Well, I try every day to spend at least a few minutes thinking about things to be grateful for. And it sounds terribly American and pretentious, but it isn't, because there are lots of things that I have to be grateful for. I've got a nice house, got a garden, I've got a supportive, loving partner, I have an income, and so many people don't have any of those. Yes. So at the lowest times when, you know, the world looks particularly dark, I find just focusing on actually this is good and this is good and this is good helps.
Yes, being grateful.
Helps me anyway.
Being grateful, isn't it, of what you've got?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Very challenging times for everyone, definitely.
Yeah.
So can you just tell us a little bit of background about yourself?
So I was born in Lancashire, which I know is a place dear to your own heart.
You just down road from me, weren't you?
Just down road, aye. But you've retained the accent and I have not.
Yes.
Partially because I had a French mother, and so I was partially schooled in Paris as a child, a time when one goes to school. And then I came to university in London and stayed down south ever since. I ended up working in the Foreign Commonwealth Office. My background was in language testing, and I was recruited as the senior language testing specialist in the Foreign Commonwealth Office. And it was whilst I was doing that job that in 2006 I was diagnosed with HIV. At the same time, I was told I had an AIDS diagnosis and my AIDS-defining illness was progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, which is a brain disease. And in my case, it affected the cells at the base of the brain, which are the ones that govern your motoring skills. I was paralyzed. I lost the use of my arms, my legs, the ability to speak, lost a great deal of memory, and so on and so forth. It took 2 years for me to get a diagnosis. Over that two-year period, I was becoming increasingly unwell. And obviously, this was noted at work, that I was not my usual self, underperforming, something's clearly wrong. I saw lots of different specialists, had lots of different tests. Nobody could give me a diagnosis. And it wasn't until Richard, my partner, who was so concerned, started coming with me to see the various specialists. We ended up going to see a chest specialist to get in a local hospital. They thought they'd found something on my lungs, which turned out to, in the end, just to be chickenpox scars, so nothing serious. Yeah. But this particular specialist, recognizing that we are a same-sex couple, had the brainwave to ask if I'd ever had a HIV test, and I hadn't. Richard and I had been together at that point 10 years in a monogamous relationship. I'd only had one previous partner. And even though, you know, I was in my early 20s when the tombstones and the icebergs floated across our TV screens, and that leaflet came through the letterbox. And yes, I was aware. I thought I was informed. I thought I was intelligent. But when this consultant said to me, have you ever had HIV tests? I said, no, I haven't, but please test me for anything, because actually I think I'm going mad.
Made you quite frightening, frightened, and
I was frightened because I didn't know what was happening.
Yeah.
Part of me thought people must think I'm pretending this to try and attract attention. Part of me literally thought that I was losing my mind. Part of me was so tired. I was just so tired. And part of me just wanted to lie down and go to sleep and never wake up. So when he offered me the HIV test, I said, please do it. I had the test done on, remember these dates so clearly, Thursday, the 31st of August, 2006. Richard and I were due to go on holiday for 2 weeks on the Saturday. So I said to the consultant, I'll pick up results when I come back. There's no rush. The following day, being my last day working down the office, I struggled into work as usual to put on my out-of-office message. When I got home that afternoon, Richard was supposed to be packing the suitcases. Got home, no cases packed. And when I said to him, well, why? What's happening? He took me in his arms and he started to cry. And Richard's a big chap, physically, emotionally, 10 years at that point together. I'd never seen him cry before, so I knew it was something serious. He told me the specialist had phoned home to get my office number so that he could call me to tell me about my diagnosis and to say that if I went away for 2 weeks, I would come home in a cardboard box. Richards apparently said to the consultant, no, I'll tell him when he comes home. And so it was the man that I love, the man that loves me, that told me I could die within 2 weeks.
Oh, God. Devastating stuff at that time.
It was.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's odd because part of me was relieved that they'd actually found something. I'm not going mad. I'm not making it up. There is actually something happening. And that weekend, I slept most of it. When I was awake, Richard would come and sit on the end of the bed and we would discuss my funeral plans.
I suppose there was a relief, as you said.
It was.
Yeah.
And on the Monday morning, he and I went together to the local sexual health clinic and they said to me, you are undoubtedly extremely ill. We're going to put you on treatment straight away, which in those days was pretty unusual. If you adhere to the treatment, hopefully we'll be able to save your life, but your lifespan may be shortened. And we don't think that you'll ever be able to walk again. Well, 16, 17 years later, I now walk and I now talk. And when the sun is shining, I can manage to do both at the same time, which is amazing.
Yes.
It's absolutely amazing.
So what was the changing point then? What started you on your journey? Because I know you wrote the book about Ripples on the Edge of Life, about your experiences.
Yeah. I was off work for 5 months learning how to walk and talk again. Sexual health records are kept separate and confidential to other medical records. My employers, the Foreign Office, were only told that I had the encephalopathy, nothing about the HIV or AIDS or indeed the two-week diagnosis. My first day back at work, I shared the full diagnosis with my immediate line manager, not for pity or sympathy, but for support and understanding. And she offered me that. But she and I agreed that she needed to tell HR. So off she went to HR, and almost immediately HR came back, sent me a little email saying, they forbade me to share the information about my diagnosis to anybody else because they, my employers, did not want to be held responsible for how other people may react or respond to that. And that, they shut the door in my face. And that sent me on a spiral of mental health decline. I felt isolated. I felt vulnerable. I felt rejected. Until the point where a few months later, Rich and I live very close to the River Thames. Early on a Saturday morning, I found myself sitting on the bank of the Thames with my feet in the water. Richard found me and stopped me from doing anything else. But on the following Monday morning, going back into work as people gather around the coffee point and share stories of what they got up to over the weekend, all I wanted to say was, I tried to kill myself. But I didn't say it because I was scared of how people might react or respond. And it was then that it's kind of the idea came to me that I cannot be alone in this. In such a large organization, there must be other people who are going through similar experiences, have been through similar experiences, whose voices are not being listened to, or whose voices are not heard. And the impact of that can be devastating. And so I eventually shared information about my diagnosis, much against the will of HR. The following World AIDS Day, I decided to invite some speakers in from Terence Higgins Trust to give a talk about living with HIV. And I put posters up around the office advertising the event, saying that I was organizing it as a colleague living with HIV and AIDS, and put my phone number on the posters. Posters were defaced. Some of them were graffitied. Wow. Oh. Some of them were slashed with a knife or scissors. Some were pulled off the walls and trodden on or torn into shreds. My land manager told me she'd removed some of them before I could see them because she thought it would be too distressing for me. And that kind of, it terrified me, but it also hardened my resolve. And thinking logically about it, this kind of gut-wrench reaction is caused by fear.
Yes, absolutely.
Fear causes stigma.
Yes.
My purpose was to educate and inform. And I would much have preferred had people picked up the phone and let loose whatever they wanted to say to me over the phone. And then at least I could have attempted to try and inform them about the realities of living with HIV.
It's a very powerful negative attitude, isn't it? Stigma and fear. And it's very difficult to break down, isn't it? And especially
it is.
In our workplace as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why nowadays I'm doing some work with Positive Allies, which is a charter mark created by the University of Sunderland for organizations that have employees or volunteers who want to signal that they are fully informed and aware of what HIV and AIDS mean and are fully prepared to support any of the people that work for them who may be living with the condition. It's so fundamentally important. I do lots of voluntary work in the HIV and AIDS sector in the UK and have encountered many people who have had appalling reactions from their employers when they've been courageous enough, brave enough to be open about their HIV status. And again, it's through lack of information. I have to say, this happened at the Foreign Office 13 years ago. They have moved on considerably in that time.
Yeah.
We together, they and I, learned a lot through that very, very painful experience for me and for them. I eventually became Diversity and Inclusion Officer there. I became Chair of the Disabled Staff Network and enabled other colleagues living with different disabilities to find their voice, to speak up and speak out, and change the culture of the workplace to one where people felt confident and safe to be able to share sometimes those very personal things about what it means to be living with a disability.
That's what people want to know, isn't it? And want to feel that there is support out there.
Absolutely. And
can you, for our listeners, if someone's going through what you went through at work, what's the bit, how could they channel that and get support?
Well, obviously, Charity Against Trust is a prime agency for support. I eventually also joined a union. And when I approached the union, I wasn't a member before all this happened. They said to me, well, we don't usually take on pre-existing situations, but yours sounds really interesting. So, yes, we'll get on board. And they appointed a union officer to support me. In the 2 years of meetings that I had with HR to try and come to an agreeable compromise situation, which we eventually did. Yeah. Without that union rep by my side, I would probably have left the Foreign Office, and who knows what would have happened.
Yeah. So you're also a founder and of Luminate, is that?
I was. So eventually, after gaining experience and qualifications in Foreign Office, I took voluntary redundancy from them in 2015 and set up my own company, Luminate, yeah, as a disability consultant. So primarily working with individuals, adults, who became disabled later in life, offering them coaching. Most times the situations were around staying in employment or finding employment. And these are people with different disabilities, not just HIV. Okay. And many times for somebody who becomes disabled later in life, they experience a huge loss of self-confidence. They have to find the new them. They have to rebuild a new identity. And if you are not in a supportive work environment, that becomes even more difficult. So I work with individuals, I work with organizations who want to become more disability aware, disability friendly, disability confident. And I worked with a number of the larger national charities that support people who are going through the disability that they represent. Due to COVID, work kind of collapsed middle of last year. So I eventually closed Luminate down, but I still work as an associate trainer for the Employers Network on Equality and Engagement, for the Business Disability Forum, and for Disability Rights UK. So I am still working with an eye to gently sliding into semi-retirement at a certain point.
Why not?
Sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
But yeah, Luminate itself no longer exists as such.
So talking about COVID and the similarities between HIV and COVID, do you think there's any lessons we can learn from especially when the AIDS crisis in the 80s and 90s?
There should be. There should be. In terms of the stigma that was experienced, that is still being experienced by people living with HIV and AIDS, stigma is actually, it's a hardwired response in us, because we have evolved reactions, responses to when we see things that make us scared of what we're seeing. It's called parasite avoidance. So reactions that make us feel disgusted when we see things like skin lesions or people vomiting or that kind of stuff, it's a normal, natural reaction of avoidance. But we need to understand it. And there's also the moral judgment side of it. So with COVID, there are some people who will say, well, you know, that person went out without a mask on. They were socializing, they weren't maintaining their bubble, so it happened to them. Same thing with HIV and AIDS. I commissioned a national survey to mark the 30th anniversary of World AIDS Day in 2018.
Yeah.
2,000 people were phoned with five questions to try and evaluate what their level of information was about HIV and AIDS and what their response to it is. And the results were staggering. This is 2018, only 3 years ago. One of the questions people were asked was, if a friend of yours told you that they were living with HIV or AIDS, what would your response be? Five answers, ranging from it wouldn't make any difference to I would actually completely cut that friendship off.
Wow.
Out of those 2,000 people, an astonishing 21% said they would no longer be friends with somebody who told them that. And when the results were broken down into age demographics, the biggest group of people who said they wouldn't maintain that friendship, the 25 to 34-year-olds, where 55% of them, over half of that age group, said they would no longer be friends with somebody living with HIV or AIDS.
It's just
that's scary.
It's astounding, isn't it, those figures?
It is.
Especially after so many years of working and trying to get...
But then, you know, but they were also asked the question, do you think there's a cure for HIV? And only 38% of the people said that they were aware that there was no cure. So 62% thought that there is a cure for HIV. There has been no public government-led campaign of information since the Icebergs and the Tombstones of 86, which was a campaign of fear, which wanted to introduce an instantaneous response, an instantaneous reaction to a pandemic.
Yeah.
Has the lesson been learned in the way that COVID has been handled? I'm not going to make a political statement here, but I suggest not. The messaging that has come out has not been clear,
yeah,
has led to confusion and so on and so forth.
We've got a new show on Channel 4, It's a Sin. So that's kind of looking back at around the 80s, wasn't it? So have you seen that? And
I've only watched the first episode because I'm taking it bit by bit. I think binge watching it maybe too emotional. So I'm pacing myself. Yes. You binge watched it, did you?
I binge watched the whole lot.
And you survived.
Yeah, my eyes were spinning at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting, because you moved down from Accrington, didn't you?
London, to the big lights, yeah. Well, I didn't actually sort of find, in inverted commas, my sexuality until I was in my late 20s.
Right.
So even when I was at university and so on and so forth, it was, I kind of knew I was different, but I didn't do anything about it. So unlike what I saw in the first episode of It's a Sin, I didn't go out clubbing and all that kind of stuff. That wasn't where I was at. But I think one of the important things for people to remember, those people who are watching It's a Sin, is that the treatment of HIV has moved on enormously since that time.
Absolutely.
And we need to repeat the message, U equals U, undetectable equals untransmittable. So for those that don't know, people who are on adherent to the effective medication, the viral load in their bloodstream is so low that it can't be detected when we try to measure it, so it's undetectable. The virus is then so weak that it can't be passed on to anybody else when people engage in what could be seen to be risky behavior.
Yeah.
And we're here in the UK. There are certain cities that have met the United Nations target of 90-90-90. 90% of people living with HIV have been diagnosed. 90% of those people are on effective treatment, and 90% of those people are undetectable, which is great.
Yeah.
But out of the 106,000 people that are living with HIV in the UK, there's something like 6,000 or 7,000 people who haven't yet been diagnosed, who don't know that they are living with HIV. And that's kind of the ticking time bomb, because they may go out and engage in potentially risky behavior without realizing that they could be infecting the person that they are engaged in that behavior with. Those are the people that we need to capture. Frequent testing is really important. If you are engaged in sexual behavior without condoms, without other protection, then you need to get yourself tested regularly. Fortunately, nowadays, of course, we've got the wonderful PrEP, and whoopee, yes, that it's now available on the NHS. How difficult was it to get that to happen?
It took a while, didn't it?
It took a while. But then, of course, we are seeing an increasing number of men, gay men, who are being diagnosed with other sexual diseases, gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia, all treatable, but nonetheless unpleasant. PrEP doesn't protect you from any other sexually transmitted disease other than HIV. So you need to get that message out as well.
Well, we're in the middle of national HIV testing as well, aren't we, at the moment?
We are.
So that's it's good to get that message out.
Good plug, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. Have you got anything else planned in the future? You've got positive allies.
Positive allies. Yeah. I'm a Positive Voices speaker for Terence Higgins Trust. So again, I do that on a voluntary basis along with all the other Positive Voices speakers. We go and talk to schools, employers, any group of people that are willing to have us come in and talk about our experiences of living with HIV. So that all kind of keeps me ticking over at the moment.
Yeah, and that's good. No, that's the best way to be at the moment. So you've chosen a track to end our interview.
A track.
Did I say twat?
A song.
A song.
I do.
Could you tell us about it?
Well, you know, as a gay man, it is one of those gay anthems, but the lyrics are particularly pertinent. So what I've chosen is "I Am What I Am" from Nakajo Fall. And the lyrics are pertinent because, for example, it says, "I don't want praise, I don't want pity. I bang my own drum, some think it's noise, I think it's pretty. Your life is a sham till you can shout out, I am what I am. It's one life and there's no return and no deposit. One life, so it's time to open up your closet." So for me, it was hugely empowering writing the book. I obviously, before I wrote it, I discussed with Richard because he figures a lot in my part of the book. And whilst the book is out there, there's no knowing where it will end up.
Yeah.
And this is one of the ripples. And so I discussed it with him, you know, his family and so on and so forth, and it was all fine. But it's empowering because I have nothing to hide. It's all out there. It's all in the public domain. There are no secrets. So for me, this song is particularly pertinent because I have this one life. There's no return. There's no deposit. I've opened up my closet.
Little duet. Yeah, it's a fantastic track, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It gets me every time.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. Do you want to just plug your book just quickly?
Okay, so the book is called Ripples from the Edge of Life, and it is available on Amazon, or you can order it through the Ripples website, which is ripplesfromtheedge.com.
Fabulous. Brilliant.
Thank you for inviting me.
If people want to get in contact with Positive Allies, is there a website? Or
It's on the University of Sunderland's website. Okay. I can let you have the link for it.
Yeah, we can put that on our Facebook page and associated platforms.
Jolly good.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you very much. And you're listening to Radio Reverb, the HIV Hour. This is Casio Fowles' version of "I Am What I Am." Thank you very much. Thanks, Roland.
Thank you.
I am what I am.
Radio Reverb.
I probed into its mysteries. Every clue told me a different story.
Radio Reverb.
Here's a question I'd like to ask you. You know a loved one, that could be a partner, could be a child, could be a husband or partner, or a very best friend, or someone you know. They have been on the transplant list for a couple of years, that they've been waiting for a new liver. And time is running out. And then someone living with HIV, who is a donor, because HIV positive people can donate their organs, is available. There's a match. But like I said, this donor is HIV positive. Would you allow that transplant to go ahead? Now, bearing in mind today, people with HIV, living with HIV, live happy and normal lives because the medication they take on a daily basis gives them that. Well, patients could be saved by organs from donors with HIV is the headlines in the Times today. And it says Britain may become the first country to allow transplant patients to receive HIV-infected organs when they do not have the virus themselves. The NHS Blood and Transplant, which is responsible for UK transplants, is considering a new programme in which infected organs from dead donors could be donated to save the lives of people who do not have HIV. Such surgeries would give someone dying of acute liver failure a new lease of life, though they would need to take antiviral HIV medication for the rest of their lives. Now, there's around about 6,000 people on the UK's transplant waiting list, and more than 350 people died last year waiting for an organ. Almost 4,000 transplants were carried out between 2019 and 2020. Now, I don't mind telling you, and myself, I'm living with HIV, and I've been an organ donator for the last couple of years. I've got my little yellow card I carry around with me. But when that first came out, it was in other words, in the event of my death, I've left my organs to, and as it was a couple of years ago, I've left my organs to go to someone living with HIV. So that could possibly change. What would you do? What would you do if you were a parent and you have a sick child and it needs a new heart or it needs a new liver, and there's someone come forward with a match in every respect of the word? But the only thing is, this donor is living with HIV. Now, knowing what we know about HIV, lives a long, healthy life. Would you do that? Would you save your child knowing that the donor is living with HIV? Now, it does say that the person that would take the transplant, you know, on the transplant list, that would take, say, the liver from a positive person, would have to take HIV medication every day for the rest of their lives. But weigh up the costs, weigh up. You save your child, you save the person that you love. Okay, they will have HIV, and it's, you know, HIV, and we talk about this all the time. You know, HIV is a controlled condition now in the UK. What would you do? Well, I know what I would do, but that's me. I would do anything to save someone that I loved. Okay, I would need a great understanding what that would entail. I'd educate myself about what it's like to live with HIV. I'd have an understanding of the life expectancy, and then I would certainly consider it. But, and this is all, I'm thinking to myself, so much stigma is still around for people living with HIV. Wouldn't this break down some of those massive barriers? Let's see what happens. It doesn't exactly, I'm just checking my notes, it doesn't exactly say when they are going to perhaps trial this, but I think it's a really positive move forward of eradicating stigma and discrimination with people living with HIV.
Hey there, it's Tony. I'm just looking at a thing that's come out on AIDS Map recently. It's a number of LGV, which is lymphogranuloma venereum. Cases amongst gay men in England have reached new highs, and most cases being amongst men who are HIV negative. LGV had previously been concentrated and in HIV gay men. Latest reports suggest, and including cases amongst men who are HIV negative or of unknown status, these are reflecting in change of sexual behaviour, also linked to PrEP use and also the awareness of the U equals U campaign, which is undetectable means untransmittable message. LGV is a bacterial sexually transmitted infection caused by a strain of the chlamydia virus and is treated with a 3-week course of antibiotic doxycycline. It was very rare in UK until 2003, when cases started to be diagnosed amongst HIV-positive men. All these early diagnoses involved with rectal infection and were linked to condomless anal sex and fisting. The symptoms of LGV include rectal discomfort and discharge, which can be bloody or mucoid. There can be more complications if left untreated, including fistula or colitis. The feeling of malaise, there's the lymph nodes in your groin being raised, symptoms of urethral infection or urinary infection, including discharge, and problems when urinating. However, these symptoms have actually been found to be, you know, some people have them and some people have absolutely no symptoms at all. Diagnosis of the LGV virus has been associated with and is predictive of diagnosis with other STI infections, including HIV and hepatitis C. The headline finding from Public Health England's latest report is that cases of the LGV in 2019 were the highest since the re-emergence of the infection in 2013. There were 1,133 cases reported by laboratories, a 33% increase on 2018, where there were 1,076 diagnoses reported in sexual health clinics to the GUM CAD surveillance system, with 56% increase of 2018. Wow, that's a lot. To give you some kind of stats, almost all LGV cases, 98% clinical data and 99.5% laboratory reports involved men and were almost exclusively amongst gay and bisexual men, 95%. Other infections likely involving men who identified as heterosexual who had sex with other men. A few cases involving women were thought to be either among transgender women or have had miscategorised symptoms and infections. 2/3 of cases were amongst men aged between 25 and 44. The number of diagnoses increased by 46%, and in this age group. But there were also increases in the number of diagnoses on ages below 65. The number of cases increased by 79% amongst men born in the UK and 116% by men non-born in the UK, especially for those South America and the EU. 3/4 of the LGV cases were in London, where diagnosis increased by 1/3 between 2018 and 2019. Outside London, the highest number of case reports in Manchester, Brighton, Hove and Kent. Although case numbers were low, there were nevertheless 130% increase in cases in West Midlands, and 105% increase in Yorkshire and Humber, and 85% increase in the North West. Overall, LGV diagnosis amongst rates amongst HIV negative or unknown status gay men and other MSN have increased fivefold since 2013. This increase is attributed to changes in obviously the sexual mixing of sexual networks. Preliminary information on LGV epidemiologically. Preliminary information on LGV epidemiologically for 2020 has been included in the report. In January and February, the number of diagnoses were close to the late 2019 highs. But cases then started to fall after lockdown restrictions were introduced, reaching a low of approximately 20 diagnoses, almost all in London in May. The number of cases then rebound as restrictions were eased, and between June and September were where the levels were observed in December 2019. The report authors emphasise the increase in diagnosis among HIV negative and unknown status men. The increase may reflect in the greater mixing between sexual networks and HIV interventions improve. This may indicate the increased access to HIV prevention is altering sexual risk behaviour. This has been written by the authors. Finding of this report cement the need for continued use of targeted control interventions, including increased health promotion and testing in populations with higher rates of LGV, as well as an opportunity to review national guidelines. This was actually on AIDS Map, and it's on the Public Health England, and it's the report Lithogranuloma Varinium LGV in England 2019, Report Protection Report 14, brackets 23, 2020, open access.
Radio Reverb. We've got some community news now, and virtually we've got Dale Crisp, who is one of the facilitators for the new ChemSex webinars for Terence Higgins Trust. How are you doing, Dale?
Hey, Josh. I'm all right, thanks. Not too bad at all. How about yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. Thank you. Thanks for asking. So the webinars start today. Could you tell the listeners a little bit about the service?
Yeah, so the service itself, it's going to be a six-week program on Zoom on Thursday evenings from 6 o'clock in the evening till 8 o'clock in the evening. The idea of the group is for men that are living with HIV who maybe want to explore their use of chems as well. So in the ChemSex environment, so people that are maybe worried about their usage. And each week there's going to be different topics as well regarding that. So the type of things we're going to be looking at is triggers and cravings, management around some of that as well, and also management around lapses, and exploring some of the techniques as well that maybe people might want to have a go at as well to help change, perhaps, and make changes to the use of their chems as well.
Sorry, Dale, you've had experience of that, haven't you?
I have, yeah. I've had quite a lot of experience of that type of, well, ChemSex itself since about 2005. So yeah, I've not used for a little while now, probably about 16 and a half months. But, yeah, it took me to quite a few different places, to say the very least, yeah.
And support is always very important in these things, isn't it? And talking to people who've had the similar experiences.
Yes, very much, very much. And there'll also be sort of some bits and pieces that people can do in the week as well, in between the groups as well. And so we'll actually sort of provide the information for that for people to actually look at in the week between. And there's absolutely no sort of you must do this, but at the same time, it's like with any group, the more I put into it, the more, of course, I get out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll be looking at stuff around some meditation as well, breathing exercises, and you know, it's important to note, I suppose, that it's not a group to say you know that we're expecting total abstinence or anything like that. It's people that are looking at making changes, positive changes, maybe to you know where they are with their ChemSex. So yeah.
How do people get, if they're interested in this and they want to book, or they just want to look, find some more information on it, how do people get that information?
Yeah, so they can visit the Terence Higgins Trust website. So that's tht.org.uk. And then if they put a /after that and the word Chemsex, that will bring up all the information people need to get onto that. And yeah, just to mention as well that although this is week one, there may be some spaces for week two as well. So, you know, please, if you are interested, you know, just sort of contact to find out. Or there's also a telephone number as well. People can contact Paul on 07741 321 216.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on. Good luck with it. And I'm sure it's such an important service to have, especially at the moment as well. It's good to have that support, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And thank you so much for asking us as well, Josh.
No worries. Thanks, Dale.
Thanks, Josh. Take care.
Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM.
What a fab show.
Yes, as usual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, well, we have a great weekend, and take care.
Enjoy the snow.
Yes, if we get the snow, enjoy it. Be safe.
Oh, fingers crossed,
well in the snow.
Yeah. I know it's hard to get around, but I do quite like the snow.
Yeah.
Northerner.
Northerner, yes. Yeah, take care, later, everybody. Bye. Take care. Keep safe.
Bye.
Bye.
HIV Hour is the UK's only show for people living with HIV, sharing stories, news and views on living positively with the virus.